We've been working our way for several weeks now through the book of Psalms with the perspective that the Psalms are God's instruction manual for life. There's just about any and every situation that humankind is bound to face found in the Psalms somewhere, sometime. David or one of the other writers either experiences it or addresses it. There are struggles. There are celebrations, you know, losses and victories, and it's just a tremendous resource, really, that I think is too often overlooked. It seems to me, this is just my subjective experience, that the women seem to appreciate Psalms more than guys do. And I don't know why. I guess you could take a guess. Maybe the women are more touchy-feely, and they like that kind of emotional, you know, the goo factor. But there's nothing that, I mean, the Psalms were written by men about situations that men face, and I don't think there's an emotion in here that guys can't relate to. And, you know, well, you know, real men do eat quiche, and real men do admit that they actually experience these things, and there is comfort and encouragement for just about every situation throughout the book of Psalms. In Psalms 3 and 4, a couple weeks ago, we saw King David in a desperate situation. His own son was out to kill him, had announced his intention to come to Jerusalem and take out his father and take over the kingdom. And David, you know, his adrenaline was pumping and his fight or flight reflex was in full tilt. He didn't want to run from Absalom. He didn't want to be seen as a coward. He didn't want to kill Absalom because he's his son. He didn't want to be killed by Absalom because no matter who it is, you'd rather not be killed most of the time, you know? So David was in quite a mess, and we see the picture of him there, kind of a word picture of him tossing and turning and anxiety, and he was really in a desperate situation. But his trust in the Lord was such that he was able to overcome that anxiety with faith, to the point that he was able, it tells us in Psalm 3, to lay down and sleep. I lie down and I get up. Even though, and this is a key point, even though nothing had changed about his circumstances, Absalom was still coming. The threat, you know, just as real, the issues that brought on that crisis had not been resolved, but David's confidence in the Lord made it possible for him to find rest in the middle of that desperate situation. Now today, in Psalm 6, similar, you know, not exactly the same situation, but a similar thing, because what we see in Psalm 6 here is King David is just worn down to the nub. He's just a beaten man. He's so worn out physically, emotionally, and spiritually that he feels like he's going to die. Now, it doesn't say that he wants to die, but you know how it is when you get in those situations where, well, we're going to see in a minute. First of all, he's physically ill. Second of all, he's got these hassles coming at him. You know, as king, there's a lot on your plate, and there's always detractors and critics. And, you know, just ask any recent president about that. No matter what you do, there's somebody that wants to bring you down. And spiritually, he kind of feels like maybe he's been left out to dry for a minute anyway. So what does he do? Dig a hole and lie down in it? Not our hero. He has a talk with God here in Psalm 6. I'm always reminded of that Stevie Wonder song from Songs in the Key of Life. When you feel your life's too hard, just have a talk with God. And if your load's too much to bear, well, just talk to God. He cares. What a great little poem Stevie put together for us. And it's not a bad song either. See, this psalm teaches us what to do when we're weak. When life seems too hard, when your load's too much to bear, there are a few things to keep in mind. So let's begin by reading all 10 verses of Psalm 6, and then we'll dig into it verse by verse. And of course, it starts, this isn't really a verse, verse 0, I guess, if you want to put it that way, to the chief musician, with stringed instruments on an 8-string harp. And there are other ways to interpret that, but I don't know that it changes the effect of the whole psalm. A psalm of David. That's important to know. David's the author of this psalm. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your hot displeasure. Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are troubled. My soul also is greatly troubled. But you, O Lord, how long? Return, O Lord, deliver me. Save me for your mercy's sake, for in death there's no remembrance of you. In the grave, who will give you thanks? I'm weary with my groaning. All night I make my bed swim. I drench my couch with my tears. My eyes waste away because of grief. It grows old because of all my enemies. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity, for the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord has heard my supplication. And the Lord will receive my prayer. Let all my enemies be ashamed and greatly troubled. Let them turn back and be ashamed suddenly. Okay. First, let's define David's condition here. Let's see if we can't relate more personally to what he's going through. I know I can, and I'll just bet you can too. He starts in verse 2, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am weak." Now, that's a very specific word. It's a picture word. Most Hebrew words, if not all, are picture words. And this word means to be drooped, to be, you know, drooped over, to be bent over. There's a word that comes to mind that came up in our men's study last Wednesday. And in fact, it's not too late to join that if you missed us, 11 o'clock and 6:30 p.m., Wednesdays, and it's the word languish, which in the context of our men's study was presented as the opposite of flourish. You know what it's like to flourish? It's like when the weather's just right around here and it's just sunny enough, but it's just wet enough, and the plants and the flowers just seem to spring up in a couple of days because conditions are perfect for their growth. That's flourishing, and so the opposite of that, languishing. You know, conditions are anything but right for growth and that kind of thing. And that's what he means here when he says, I'm weak. It's one thing to be tired, to need a little rest, you know, need to refuel. But it's another to be so utterly exhausted that your very soul droops. Can you picture that? That's where David's at. Now, it would seem that the weakness David is experiencing here has to do with both his body and his soul. Again, verse 2, "Have mercy on me, Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are troubled." I mean, he's so wiped out that he can just feel the ache in his bones. Now, I got to say, I was reading somebody's commentary on this in the last few weeks, and this particular writer suggested that David was ill, and that may very well be. And I don't know if maybe it's just my own ignorance that I failed to see that or failed to read between the lines and arrive at that conclusion that he was talking about a physical illness. But the language, you know, heal me for my bones are troubled. That's, you know, that could very well be that he's suffering from some kind of physical infirmity. And you know how it's like, or what it's like when you're sick. A lot of us are sick now, or have been in the last few weeks, and you got a little cough or a little plugged up nose or maybe worse, and you just don't want to get out of that bed in the morning. Do I have to? You know, and maybe you don't have to, so you make it to the chair. And you don't want to get out of that chair. You know, yeah, but I really got to go. I remember being so sick as a kid that I'd be asleep. I would, you know, in the daytime, I'd go lay on my parents' bed for some reason because it was bigger than mine. I don't know, but something special about laying on mom and dad's bed. And I'd be asleep and I'd kind of drift in and out. And in those days, this is back in the old days for you kids, we had black and white TV. And of course, even then, I Love Lucy was an old show. It was in reruns. And there was this particular channel down in Portland where between 9 and noon they would play, you know, Lucy and Andy Griffith and the Bob Cummings Show. Hold it. I think you're going to like this picture. And, you know, all those, Burns and Allen and so forth, little Sergeant Bilko. And I remember being so sick, I'd lay there and I'd kind of, you know, I'd see Ricky and Lucy and then I'd kind of go like this. And when I wake up, it'd be Andy and Opie. And I'm going, well, what happened? I couldn't even stay awake to watch the shows that I love. Is the best part about being sick. You get to stay home and watch Andy Griffith. You know, they don't show it at nighttime anymore. They didn't at that point. But just, you know, to be so wiped out physically, you don't even want to roll over. You know what I mean? I think everybody's been that way a couple of times. But then the first part of verse 3, my soul also is greatly troubled. So it wasn't only a physical thing, it was also a spiritual thing. And I think soul here refers to just that inner being, my inner man, just, you know, me. The me that's still looking out when I close my eyes, you know, the real me. I'm just wiped out. Now, kind of by the way, if you recognize this language, my soul also is greatly troubled. This is one of those psalms, one of those verses that Jesus quoted, you know, right before he left. He said, my soul is greatly troubled. And he was talking about his the coming crucifixion and then his resurrection and ascension and how, you know, I'm going to leave you guys. You know, I'm sad about this. Yet it's for your own good that I leave. So body and soul, you know, physical infirmity as well as all the hassles from the outside. You know, if he has political problems, he's got family problems, and all this stuff has just taken David to the point where he feels like he's drooped over and he just can't keep going. He's not in a panic anymore. You know, it's not that fight or flight adrenaline rush anymore. Now he's just done. He's just ready to lay down. Now his plea to the Lord is for mercy, for healing, and for deliverance, right in the first part of verse 2. Have mercy on me, O Lord. And then in the second part of the verse, O Lord, heal me. And then all the way down in verse 4, return, O Lord, deliver me. Now I want you to recognize, Bible students, that in these three requests, David here is appealing to God's nature. God is merciful. God is the healer. God is the deliverer. And it's important for us to know that it's not unreasonable to ask God to respond to our situation according to his nature. Now, if you want to, you know, if you were to ask God to lie, different story. If you're to ask God to afflict someone or condemn someone, you're wasting your breath. But a prayer for God to be who he is and do what he does is a prayer that he can answer. So with that kind of picture of David's situation and the base nature of his prayer, we can dig in a little further. When you're weak, we're going to go back to verse 1. When you're weak, one of the things you got to do, and these are in no particular order, but one of the things you need to do is recognize the source of your struggle. Real important there. Look at David. Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your hot displeasure. David clearly thought that his problems were a punishment from God. Now, I'm going to go out on a New Testament limb and disagree. I'm going to correct David. Now, in the Old Testament times, right up to the days of Jesus, it was real common to believe that whenever there was a problem, an infirmity, you know, a birth defect or an illness or an injury or just any kind of calamity in anyone's life, it was, oh, well, they must have really blown it somewhere or somebody in their family did. In fact, turn with me to John chapter 9. Now, David, we're going to switch heroes here. Jesus and his guys are in the temple area in Jerusalem, and right at the top of John chapter 9. It says, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? See, that was just the assumption. This blind guy, it's got to be his fault or his parents' fault, because surely God has, you know, caused this blindness as some kind of punishment, some kind of retribution for something, because, you know, that was their idea of God. You do something God doesn't like, boy, and if you haven't sacrificed the right goats and birds and sheep and bulls and all that stuff and thrown the grain in the fire and poured the oil, then you are just out of luck and God's going to bring the hammer down. You better watch out for that lightning bolt, you know, that's going to hit you. That was the common assumption. And Jesus corrects that. He says in verse 3, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works. There's an interesting little grammatical. This is a little bit off topic, but I can't just skip over it. Grammatically, you know, in the original language, they don't have periods and commas and semicolons, and there are some other clues within the grammar that suggest the end of a sentence, the beginning of the next one, or a paragraph break and that kind of thing. It's possible, and I'm not saying this is absolutely the case, but it does kind of make sense to think of an ellipsis here, which is, you know, dot, dot, dot. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him, you know, ellipsis, dot, 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 you know, watch this. And he cures the blindness, gives the man back his sight. There's a whole great story that follows about the man's testimony and the effect that has on the Jewish believers and everybody else. But this idea that every problem, every trial is directly related to some failure, some sin, some weakness, and God is now punishing me, like, you know, go to your room or go stand in the corner or something like that, that doesn't float, folks. And it hasn't been that long. A few weeks ago, I had one of the young guys in the church. I don't forget what it was. Something went sour at school or something. I mean, we go, oh, it's no big deal. Well, when you're 14, it's your entire world, you know. And Becky doesn't like me. And so, oh, you know, and you're folding up like a, you know, like something, cards. And I got to say to this young guy, hey, you know, don't blame God. Don't think that God's punishing you. You didn't have, you know, God forgives your sin. Jesus died on the cross for your sin. The Lord doesn't punish you by, you know, making Becky not like you anymore. Or make you get transferred from your favorite class to another class, or you wanted this teacher and you got that teacher. God doesn't punish you that way. That's not how that works. It's neither reasonable nor accurate, folks, to blame God for every trial and misfortune, saying, oh, I get the Lord's just trying to teach me a lesson. And as soon as I get the lesson, then he'll, you know, release me from this burden, whatever it might be. Now, the Lord may use a trial to teach a lesson. In fact, I think you can expect the Lord to use a trial to teach a lesson, but that's not the same thing as the Lord causing the trial in the first place. You know, the fact is, we don't need any help with that. In fact, we are already, every day, we are confronted by and faced with this threefold cause of trouble that doesn't include the Lord. You know, the world, number one, the flesh, and don't forget the enemy. Don't forget the devil. He is alive and well on planet Earth, and he's out to get you. And don't ever think he's not. But think about these three things. The world we live in, kind of a broad general sense, as we pointed out last week, in the last couple of weeks, is going down the drain and doing everything it can to take you with it. Now, you can call it culture, you can call it peer pressure, you can call it just going with the flow. You know, you need to know the flow does not end well. And it brings hurt and hassles and heartbreak all along the way. The world is like a poisoned well. And when you get sick from drinking it, God's not to blame. Now, the world is one thing. Most of the time, though, I got to say, and again, this is subjective observation, we bring our own problems on ourselves. Poor judgment, bad decisions, stubbornness, pride, all those nasty negative characteristics of our human nature, we just sabotage ourselves, it seems like, all day, every day. Each of us have within us this thing that the theologians... Oh, I forgot I had my toothbrush in my pocket. Okay. We'll take that out of the tape. I just felt it there. That's not a pen. Now go ahead. Go ahead and laugh. I'm going to get a drink of water while you're busy.
Our pastor's so funny, I just wouldn't believe it. One time he had different colored socks on. And...
Most of the time we bring our problems on ourselves. We all have what the theologians call this thing called a sin nature. And it's incorporated into our physical being, into our flesh, the same as eye color, hair color, and other physical characteristics. We inherit it, literally, from our antecedents, predecedents, whatever, all the way back to, you know, Uncle Adam and Aunt Eve, or great-grandma and grandpa, however you want to look at it. We have this inherent propensity. Now, I love those two words, because they are precisely accurate. But they're also a little, you know, highfalutin, hoity-toity to kind of really get a handle on without talking about. Inherent propensity. Inherent means the same idea as inherited. Look at it this way. Dogs have an inherent propensity to bark. Birds have an inherent propensity to fly. And fish have an inherent propensity to swim. Well, the same way that those behaviors are part of the nature of those animals, for us, we have this inherent propensity to ignore even our very own ideas of what's right and what's best for us, and instead choose to indulge the cravings of the flesh, which bring unavoidable natural consequences. Living in surrender to the flesh is like playing Russian roulette. And when the gun goes off, it's not God's fault. The world, the flesh, and of course, the enemy. Don't forget the enemy, who the word tells us roams around like a hungry lion on the hunt, whose sole purpose is to steal, kill, and destroy you. Individually, each one of us, that's his mission, and he's really good at it. He's been practicing a long time, and he knows just which carrot to dangle and how close to dangle it and when to back off and when to push, and he gets us to make these bad decisions, and the next thing you know, our joy and peace, not only in the Lord, but just in the natural sense, their history, they're a distant memory, and you know, he kills our spirit and destroys our lives and then laughs all the way home. Now, see, with that, I'll call it the unholy trifecta. With that unholy trifecta in place, the Lord doesn't need to cause calamity in your life. He doesn't need to cause the car wreck or the sickness or the whatever. He doesn't need to do that. We pretty much have that covered on our own. But in the midst of those things, are there lessons to learn? Absolutely. But to blame God the way that David does is really a mistake. So the first thing you got to do is recognize the source of the struggle, and probably, you know, recognize who's not the source of your struggle. Because as resentment builds up against God, you just completely close the valve, you close off, you pinch off the pipe of any move, any work of His Spirit in your life, or any other thing God might do for you. So, that was number one, excuse me. When you're weak, you got to recognize the source of the struggle. Then, beautiful lesson in this psalm, you got to trust God's timing. Oh, I hate this. It's just so hard. My timing is so much better, for me anyway, because when I need it now, I need it now. When I'm hurting, I want pain relief now. I want to take the aspirin. I don't want to wait 20 minutes for it to get into my, maybe, you know, I want to mainline it or something. I want relief now. When my tire goes flat, I just want to snap and have like Bewitched or something and have a new tire on because it slows me down. It gets in my way. It's a pain in the neck and it's a hassle. And, you know, I don't want to wait for God or anybody else. But David here is learning and he is teaching us to trust God's timing. Look at the end of verse 3 when he says, "My soul is also greatly troubled, but you, O Lord, how long?" And it just kind of leaves us hanging there. It's how long? And, you know, Lord, my soul is troubled. In the contrast, but you, Lord, how long? How long? How long will you let this go on? How long do I have to suffer? How long till you rescue me? How long till this is over? And I think all of those are great candidates for filling in the blank if you want to finish this sentence. But it's just, how long? You know, you can just feel the frustration there. And he's weak, he's bent over, he's wiped out, he's done. It's like, Lord, how long? Reminds me of taking trips in the car with my dad, you know. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? We used to drive from Vancouver down south to Junction City, which is kind of just off the freeway between Albany and Eugene. I mean, it's not that far. I've driven that far to work and then driven home. But in those days, you know, you leave Vancouver and by the time you cross the Columbia River, are we there yet? How much longer is this going to take? And then, of course, every time we'd go by, now again, this is for you old folks like me, we'd drive by Albany, the big T&R restaurant. Remember that, anybody? With the giant neon sign that you can see for miles. It's not there anymore, but it's like, can we eat? Oh, we just ate a half an hour ago. You know, we haven't been in the car that long. Besides, you already had two candy bars and an apple that Mom packed. But it's the T&R. It's Albany. We got been in the car so long. Dad, I just can't take it anymore. You know, how long? Well, hang tight. A little bit longer. We'll be there soon. And Grandpa will take you for ice cream. He always does. Don't worry about it. But how long? We're pulling in the driveway. And I'm going, how much further is it? And that's, you know, we get that way, especially when we're in distress. You know, it's one thing, well, how long until Christmas? Well, I don't know, today's the 5th, so it must be 20 more days, or roughly. 20. But how long until this, you know, this shoulder stops hurting? How long until this relationship stops hurting? How long until this job stops stinking? Or how long until this job I don't have starts having me, you know? It's how long, how long, how long? And when it's a distressful situation, man, right now isn't soon enough. And so we all have within us this, Lord, how long? Now, there are a lot of reasons, a whole lot of reasons why the Lord might not affect your rescue immediately. I'll just touch on two because we'd be here all day. Sometimes the Lord doesn't affect your rescue immediately because he's making you stronger. Oh, don't give me that. It's like lemons into lemonade. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, no, wait a minute. I saw this in action just a couple days ago. My mom, most of you know, has been in the hospital, and she was in the ICU up at the St. Joseph's Hospital in Olympia, in Lacey, actually. And she'd been in the ICU for a few days. She hasn't been able to get out of bed. She can hardly talk. She was in pretty rough shape. She's getting better now, by the way. Thanks for praying and thanks for asking. But they finally got her up to sit in a chair, which was a huge accomplishment. And it really was, based on her condition. They got all the tubes out. There's no more breathing apparatus. There's no more none of that stuff. And she's just sitting in a chair. And I was there, and the physical therapist comes in. They're always so cheerful. I just want to kill them. Oh, Mrs. Stevens, you know, and it's like, dial back the sugar a little bit, would you please? We're talking to humans here, you know, not kitties. And of course, I'm advocating for my mother because that's her attitude. She kind of glared at her, you know. Mrs. Stevens, would you like to go for a walk? It's like, oh, sure. And then can we fly, you know? No, would you be okay? We'll get you up and we'll put this thing on you and I'll hang on the back and we'll get you a walker here and there'll be a gal over here with the oxygen and, you know, you're in the hospital. How much safer can you get? And so it's like, well, what, you know, what do you have in mind? Well, we're going to walk from here to the curtain. It was 6-8 steps maybe at the most and back. So double that. Well, okay, you know, so she gets up, you know, they help her up. It's no easy thing. She gets up on her feet and you can tell she's shaky and she hasn't walked in a month. She's been bedridden and somebody's got a hold of her here with this kind of harness thing, you know, and she's, you know, just barely able to kind of get this thing going and she gets all the way over finally to the curtain. And then the gal goes, let's see if we can make it out to the desk. And my mom's eyes got big. You know, she's too weak to fight, or she probably would have smacked her. But she made it out to the desk, and she made it all the way back. And then it was like, well, aren't you glad you did? Aren't you glad we didn't just turn around at the curtain and come back? You know, now you know, not only, you know, are you strengthened by that little tiny bit of exercise, but now you know what you didn't know a few minutes ago is that you're actually able to walk a little further than you felt like you might be able to. That little walk not only made her stronger physically, it made her stronger psychologically and emotionally in her thinking. And then that's one of the reasons the Lord doesn't just come in like Superman, you know, with a red ass and a cape and just take charge and, you know, bounce bullets off. And he's just, you know, there may be some benefit in this for you. And yeah, it's a little tough to take one more step and one more step. And right when you think you're done, you realize that now he wants me to go twice as far as, you know, before. But you do it because the Lord knows that that'll make you stronger. One of the other many reasons that the Lord might not affect your rescue immediately and leave you there in that, how long, Lord, is in order to make you utterly dependent on him. We get into a mess. You know, David, his family was a mess. We talked about that a few weeks ago. There's adultery and incest and murder, and that's just, you know, Tuesday night around the dinner table for David's house. And then there's this little thing called the kingdom, you know, where his own people are kind of in rebellion, typical politics as usual. You got they didn't have Democrats and Republicans, but they had the Davidians and the non-Davidians and anti-Davidians or whatever, and he's got to deal with that. He's got this threat from an invading army that just happens to be led by his own son, who are threatening to come down and kill him. So, you know, his plate is full. He's got lots and lots of problems. And what we learn from David, in fact, in this very psalm, in all the psalms, really, is that rather than, well, David, you know, would try to deal with things as far as he was able. Well, you know, we'll call this guy down. We'll send the message here. We'll try this strategy and these tactics, and this is how we'll go about it. And hey, I've got an idea. Let's do this. Try this approach. And then finally, it ran out of gas, and now he's just worn out again. He's drooped over in body and soul. And finally is the time when the Lord kind of says, are you through yet? Are you finished? Oh, you're finished? Okay, now I can go to work. Now I can come into your life. Now I can help you. I can advise you. I can influence you. I can direct your steps in such a way that you'll be better. You'll be stronger. You'll be back. See, the Lord wants us to depend on him entirely. I love that old song, I'm learning how to lean and depend on Jesus. He's my friend. He's my guide. See, the Lord can't catch you if you refuse to fall. You know that game they play? I don't know if it's a game, but at those encounter groups, whatever, where everybody stands behind you and you put a blindfold on and you fall. I don't know if you've ever tried that, but like when you're up 6 or 10 feet, that's really hard to do. And you look, yeah, they're still there. They got their catcher's mitts out and stuff, and they're good to go. And they're bigger than me, and there's 10 of them, and I'm only one of me. But you're something in your brain, in your body, that just says, don't do it. Don't let go. But the thing is, if you never let go, they can't catch you. And if we don't let go, the Lord can't catch us. He wants us to trust him enough to be completely dependent on him so that we don't even look behind us. We just let her rip. We just, Lord, I'm falling because I know you'll catch me. And sometimes he leaves us in these weakened conditions lets us, you know, use up our resources and our ideas and run out of options. And then finally we give up trying to do for ourselves what only he can do. And then he's right there to step right in. When you're weak, you got to trust God's timing. Then, and this may be the greatest lesson of this psalm, you got to remember that it's okay to pour your heart out in prayer. Not just okay to pray. Throw up a quick prayer a little time. It's okay to pour your heart out. Now, before we get into the text here, pouring your heart out needs to be an unguarded process. And what I mean by that is, you know, in the military or in sometimes in legal system, there'll be an exchange, and then someone will say, permission to speak freely, sir? And if the sir says, permission granted, then you can say, you're just a real jerk. You're doing this all wrong. You're blowing it. You're going to crash the ship or wreck the plane or, you know, whatever. But you got to have that permission to speak freely first. Well, we have permission to speak freely with our Heavenly Father. And so if we don't speak freely, if we try to edit ourselves, it's just silly. We'll get back to the idea in a minute. Verses 3 through 10, the rest of the passage, I want you to notice how David doesn't hold anything back. He doesn't hold anything back. He already misdiagnosed his own problem in verse 1. In verses 2 and 3, he tells God exactly how he's feeling. There's no mealy mouth, well, Lord, you know, I kind of, sort of, maybe once in a while lose a little. No, heal me! Have mercy! Deliver me! My bones are troubled. My soul is troubled. He's just pouring it out. It's like, I don't want to get too graphic here in the company of believers, but there's this little thing your body does when it has stuff inside that has to get out. And you don't really want to do that, but the body says, I don't care what you want. You need to purge. Well, that's kind of the idea here. He tells God exactly how he feels. In verse 4, he appeals to God's mercy, which is God's nature. Verse 5, start with that. For in death there is no remembrance of you. In the grave, who will give you thanks? Now be careful, because you can't take this psalm, this pouring out of the heart in the form of a song, which is what a psalm is, and create a doctrine, because there are those who would point to this to support this theory, this wild thing called soul sleep, where when we die, our souls don't go to be with the Lord the way Jesus says they do. You know, this day you'll be with me in paradise. Oh no, it's just kind of, you're dormant and you're asleep there for a season until the Lord kind of wakes you back up. There's arguments on both sides of that, but this verse is not one that you can use to support that. He's simply making the point that's like, Lord, I'm so weak, I'm so hurting, I'm so out of it that I feel like I could die. And if I die, I won't be able to praise you. It's kind of a statement of affection, really. In the grave, who gives thanks? That's all he's saying. Verses 6 and 7, he continues to just tell it like it is. I'm weary with my groaning. You know, how many of us have the courage to look at God and say, I'm tired of this? You know, usually we don't have the gall. We think that that's somehow insulting. But the whole point here is to just let it rip. You know, let that stuff out. All night I make my bed swim. I drench my couch with tears. Obviously poetic language. You know, I cry so much that I can swim in my bed. You know, my eyes waste away because of my grief. It grows old. You know, I'm getting tired of this. It grows old because of all my enemies. He just tells it like it is. I don't think it can be overstated that full disclosure and transparency are the key to effective prayer. See, there's nothing in your heart that God doesn't already know about. And so, to censor your prayers, try to tell God what you think he wants to hear and not tell him what you may think he doesn't want to hear it serves no purpose except maybe to reveal the foolishness of our thinking, because he already knows it all anyway. There's nothing you can say and no way you can say it that will embarrass God, that will offend God, or surprise God. So just tell him what's on your mind. It's been a while now, but there was a season where all of my prayers started with, God, I hate this. He's like, oh, nice talking to you too. You know, but he couldn't wait till, you know, the appointed hour of prayer. God, I hate this. I can't stand this. Okay, he's just going, let me have it, keep it going, get it all out, you know. And then finally you run out of steam with that stuff. Psalm 62:8. Don't look it up, but maybe jot down the reference, because David tells us what he implies here. He says explicitly in Psalm 62, trust him at all times, you people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. He's our safe place. He's that secret place that we can go to, and he's always there, and nobody else can get to us or get at us. So we just be honest. Pour your heart out. Now, David pours his heart out regarding his weakness, obviously, but he doesn't stop there. The last thing he does in these last two verses is turn his thoughts and his faith to the way out of his weakened condition. Verse 8. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity. And for iniquity, if you're just as a paraphrase, use the word godlessness. All of you who have no concern for the things of God, and live your lives as though God didn't care or God didn't exist. Depart from me. That goes back to Psalm number 1. You know, don't hang out with the people that don't have time for God or make time for God in their lives. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity, for, here's why, the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord hears. David's not just venting to blow off some steam. The Lord hears. The Lord has heard my supplication. The Lord will receive my prayer. Interesting, in Hebrew, this word receive means to take it and run with it. Let all my enemies be ashamed and greatly troubled. You know, let them be ashamed instead of me, says David. Let them turn back and be ashamed suddenly. You know, suddenly in the sense of as the Lord starts to go to work and can't be denied or avoided anymore. Because God hears and receives our prayers, it's our enemies that should be troubled. You realize that? When our prayer lives take on the characteristics of David's prayer life, and then we start to bear the fruit of that and see the results of that, you get to the point where those enemies, whatever form they may take, family, friends, co-workers, IRS agents, you know, whatever it might be, they finally get to the point where they can think, don't mess with her. Don't mess with that guy. God's on their side. I've been there, done that. I've seen it. Do not mess with it, you know. Don't mess with them. I know that we all feel sometimes it seems you just can't catch a break. You know what I mean? You're not feeling well to begin with for whatever reason. Then the boss gets all over you at work. And then there's some kind of fallout in the family. And you're so weighed down with all this stuff. You're way beyond panic. You're way beyond, well, I'm going to fix this because you tried and it didn't work out. And now you're just drooping. You're just weak. You're worn out and you're feeling like you're done. That is when having a good long talk with your Heavenly Father restores the soul. Remember that little line in Psalm 23? I'll read the first. This is, everybody knows Psalm 23. I'll read the first couple of verses. The Lord is my shepherd. You know, he's the one that guides me and looks out for me and provides for me. I shall not want, which means I have everything I need. He makes me to lie down, that is, find rest. In green pastures, you know, there's plenty to eat. He leads me beside the still waters. My thirst is satisfied. He restores my soul. You know, my soul was weary and weak. He restores it. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. See, we remember to have those long talks where you're just, you know, painfully honest and telling God what's on your heart. You're not really telling him because he doesn't know. You're telling him because you need to get it out. And then, just like David, even though nothing has changed on the outside, strength, encouragement, even joy began to lift you up. Because lifting burdens and straightening bent backs is the business the Lord is in.